from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Thoroughbred racetracks have become increasingly dangerous for horses and jockeys. About 24 horses a week die at racetracks. Many break down with injuries masked by injected painkillers. Today we talk with Walt Bogdanich and Joe Drape of the New York Times about their investigation into horse racing. Part of the problem, they say, is lax regulation, which enables unscrupulous owners and trainers to inject horses with performance-enhancing drugs, including some unusual substances like cobra venom.
What it does is it paralyzes that particular part of the leg, and the horse cannot feel pain. Now, unfortunately, according to the people who want cleaner, more honest races, they do not have a test for that.
Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Dark Shadows. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is the time of year when horse racing captures the nation's attention with the running of the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont Stakes. But our guests, New York Times writers Joe Drape and Walt Bogdanich, say American tracks are increasingly scenes of ghastly accidents in which the horses are crippled, then euthanized, and jockeys sometimes suffer serious injuries. Drape and Bogdanich report that too often horses are running with injuries disguised by injected pain relievers or racing on performance-enhancing drugs. In a series of articles, they write that regulation of horse racing is lax and the economics of the sport have been skewed by the addition of casinos to many racetracks. Walt Bogdanich is an investigative reporter for The Times and the winner of two Pulitzer Prizes. Joe Drape is an award-winning sports writer who's covered racing at The Times since 1998. They spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies about the problems they've identified in the racing industry.
Well, Joe Drape, Walt Bogdanich, welcome to Fresh Air. Joe Drape, do you want to describe one of the accidents that illustrates these problems?
A little history on here. 1999, Charismatic is in the Triple Crown running for a chance at history and breaks down in mid-stretch. The jockey Chris Antley holds his leg up, very dramatic. That then was a one-day story. I was on the beat then. In 2008, we flash forward to Eight Bells, who is the filly running in the Kentucky Derby, finishes the race, breaks both her legs right there at the end of it. That, I think, is where it pierced everybody's consciousness, that we've become sort of a culture and a community and environment of people worried about health and welfare of animals. And when we went to go get the data, I'd seen it on the racetrack, Walt had seen it on the racetrack, increasingly the public had seen it on the Triple Crown broadcast, again, Barbaro in 2006. So, I mean, we did want to quantify it, and we wanted to see how many and how often it actually happened. So those are the accidents, and the accidents are they snap their legs. Dr. Rick Arthur, the medical professional out in Santa Anita, said something that's very, I guess, moving to me, is how often do you see an Olympic athlete snap its leg off? We see it all the time in horse racing. So those were the accidents we wanted to try to explain.
One of the issues that you confront in doing the reporting here is that there are many different organizations, many different interests, kind of a patchwork of regulations. And to get a sense of it, you purchased these, 150,000 records. Explain exactly what these records were.
These are records of races, descriptions of those races that are put together by what in the industry are known as chart callers. They're trained to use certain words to describe what happens to each horse in a race. So what we did is we purchased more than 150,000 races, and we isolated key words that would indicate that a horse either broke down or showed signs of an injury. And that took quite a lot of doing. I mean, we spent months collecting this data, double-checking it, weeding out possible duplicates. An extraordinarily difficult process, but we thought it was worth it. And indeed, it did. It revealed certain truths about racing that up until that point, had not been publicly known.
And you want to just summarize some of the key findings from that analysis?
Well, for instance, that quarter horse races, horses who race shorter distances on the same tracks, regulated by the same state officials, that they were breaking down 29% more than thoroughbreds, for example. And we looked at cheaper horses and whether they, in fact, broke down more often than the more expensive horses, more valued horses. And in fact, they were. And we then started to look at the relationship between the purse money, the prizes, and the value of the horse. And that's an area that Joe can explain a little bit better than I can. But basically, when you have a relatively cheap horse and a huge prize, the risk and reward gets out of balance. And if there's little risk and a huge reward, trainers and owners are going to take chances that they otherwise wouldn't do and end up putting rider and animal at risk.
The other thing we did is we brought in all the death certificates and necropsies for the 38 racing jurisdictions and tried to get a handle on how often horses died and how often they were tested and found positive for drugs. And I think the startling and noteworthy number there is 24 and a half horses a week, 24 horses a week, die at the racetrack. And that is a number that had never really been, I guess, found, discovered, quantified.
And then there's the jockeys. Tell us about Jackie Martin.
Well, Jackie Martin is an incredible story. A national champion jockey who was at the top of his profession when, as often happens, people have too much money and sometimes lose their way. And he was suspended for 4 years. And he came back, really not expecting anyone to embrace him. But he was so good and such a, in many ways, despite his mistakes, an honorable, good man, that they gave him chances to come back. And he immediately began winning again out in the Southwest. And then there was, to set the scene, our data showed that New Mexico was had the worst safety record. So I went out there to see for myself what was going on, and it was the sixth race that I attended. And I was at the rail when Jackie Martin's horse broke its leg and threw him headfirst into the ground. And he nearly died, and nearly died a number of times afterwards. He's now paralyzed on a respirator. And, it's a shocking event to witness. Even more shocking when the next day, virtually the same thing happened. Just past the finish line, a horse threw its rider, broke a leg. This rider was more fortunate and walked away. So, that's the human dimension of this. I've heard a lot of people say that, well, jockeys have a choice. They decide to get involved in this obviously dangerous line of work. Horses don't have a choice. And so many people care more passionately about the horses. I care about both of them.
And what would a jockey like Jackie Martin be paid? What do jockeys make on races?
Jockeys typically get 10% of the purse. Jackie Martin was racing before he was injured, critically injured. He was set to race in one of the richest races in the world, where it was more than $1 million purse. And he would have been extraordinarily well compensated. He was on the favorite. But he races horses, as he told us. And he said, this is what I do for a living. So he got on a cheaper horse and broke down and is paralyzed, hopefully not for life, but he's still on a respirator. And he earned basically $60 for that race. It's the life of a jockey. They know what they're getting into. They don't want to take unreasonable chances. Jackie was one of the most respected quarter horse jockeys in the world. He'd won all kinds of titles, admired, respected by all people in the industry. And now he's lying in a bed attached to a respirator. It's tragic. Accidents happen. But among the people we've talked to in the veterinary community, there are steps that could be taken that might lessen the number of Jackie Martins out there.
And in typical kind of lower purse races, the run-of-the-mill races that you see in tracks around the country, so jockeys are not making a lot of money on those races.
No, jockeys do not make a lot of money. They're the leading guys, the guys we're going to watch in the Derby and the Triple Crown, they may earn $17 million in purses, which about 10% they keep, 1.7, 25% goes to the agent. These are 20 guys, all right? There's 300 guys that are lucky to get $100,000 a year, $200,000 a year, and take their money out of there. So, for every Jerry Bailey and Gary Stevens, there's 100 guys nobody's ever heard of that don't have insurance and are just eking out a living.
We're speaking with Walt Bogdanich and Joe Drape, both reporters for the New York Times, who have done a series on problems in horse racing. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are Joe Drape and Walt Bogdanich. They've been investigating problems in the horse racing industry and have written several articles in the New York Times. Now, at the heart of a lot of this is, you know, using medications to get horses onto the track that maybe shouldn't be running and to also enhance their performances in ways that create risks. What are some of the substances horses are injected with?
Well, we looked specifically at pain medicine, and there are many different kinds of pain medicine. And the reason we did that is because if you use it indiscriminately, if you use it on race day, which it is allowed up to certain levels in the United States that a horse can race on pain medicine, that what it does is it masks injuries in some cases. And that can be dangerous because horses that cannot feel the pain are going to race in a way that they otherwise wouldn't. And that puts, again, animal and rider at risk. So we were looking at pain medicine and the different kinds. Separately from that, there's a separate category of drugs called performance-enhancing drugs, which are illegal. And the industry often says, well, there aren't that many instances of illegal drugs, performance-enhancing drugs. Well, in part that's true, in part it's not true, because some performance-enhancing drugs cannot be detected by current testing methods. But we thought it was more important to look at the pain medicine because it's allowed, because it was an accepted part of racing in the United States, and because it is not an accepted part of racing in Europe. And we thought that it was striking that the breakdown injury rates are quite different in Europe than they are in the United States.
So are there rules and regimens that govern, you know, the injection of medication into horses at tracks?
There are, Dave, but the problem is there's 38 different jurisdictions. There's no law and order anywhere. There is no uniform rules in America. Every state is different. They are state agencies. They don't have big budgets, and they don't have a lot of willpower to go do some things like this. That's probably the biggest problem is no law and order. And when you look over at the rest of the world, Hong Kong, England, France, Australia, there's nationalized agencies with set rules, and their breakdown rates are half of what the U.S.'s are.
What struck me in reporting this story is how often stakeholders in the industry, the leaders of the industry, just about all you know, segments of the industry would privately say, well, you know, we wish there was uniformity in laws, uniformity in punishment. But until, you know, the next state does it, we're not going to do it because we're going to be at a disadvantage. And racing is a struggling sport, and some would say a dying sport. The old supporters are dying off, and there's many other options for people now to entertain their gambling hunger. So it's important to look at these sorts of things.
The economic ecosystem of horse racing is very much out of whack. Everybody has their own agenda and their own set of interests. Racetracks want full fields, so they will attract betting money, and they take a percentage of that. Breeders want sounder horses because they are taking them to auction, and they want to get the highest price. Horsemen, trainers, owners, they want to run for high purses. So that's why they increasingly turn to the casino model. So what happens is you have four or five groups at odds with each other, and the only thing they can agree on is let's kind of keep it the same because it's been working.
Now, when a horse is injected with a medication that will make it run through an injury and perhaps increase the risk of breaking down, does the jockey know?
The jockey knows that horses are receiving pain medication, but even the best of them have difficulty or are totally unable to detect that a horse has a problem, might be slightly injured, because they're not showing it when they warm up. And it's also dangerous to be injecting these horses with pain medication before the track vet does a pre-race inspection of the horse, which is done for everyone's safety, safety of the horse, safety of the jockey, to make sure that the betters are protected. If they are examining a horse and that horse is on pain medication, certain levels of pain medication, those injuries, that lameness will not show up. And vets have told us time and time again that they wish the allowable levels of pain medicine were lower, because at current levels, in many states, they are unable to truly evaluate the condition of the horse.
The thing that's been remarkable for me, I've covered this now for 15 years, is the jockeys will tell you there are certain horses and trainers they won't ride. They won't come out publicly with that because they're independent contractors and they're afraid they're going to lose mounts, they're going to lose business if they say that aloud. There were federal hearings last week, and they asked several jockeys to come forward. The only one who did was Gary Stevens, a retired Hall of Fame jockey. And he said something that I found fascinating and kind of gives you the insight in here, is he would get on a horse, and what he worried is it was a horse that he's probably ridden 10 times and was 8 or 9 years old, and it was like an old truck. You knew it's gimp, it's limp, it took a while to get warmed up. And then he would switch barns to another trainer, and all of a sudden he'd get on, and it was like being on a Porsche. And he said, you know, that was his tip-off, that something was given to this horse. So there is an awareness among the jockey colony, but at the same time, there's a wariness to step forward and say something.
So as a group, it's in their interest to see less of this doping, but day-to-day, it's hard for them to do anything about it.
Well, that's correct, and we reported about one of the rare instances where jockeys got together and actually boycotted the horses of a particular owner in Pennsylvania. That's rare because, as Joe pointed out, these are independent contractors. You get a reputation for turning down mounts and being a quote-unquote troublemaker. You're not going to have enough income to survive on the racing circuit.
Maybe you should just tell that story. This is Penn National, which is near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, right?
This is, and Penn National is a track that, you know, was sort of the forerunner to the casino era. They're a track that's really done that well, has built a casino, and they run basically year-round. And there was an owner named Michael Gill, and Michael Gill had won an Eclipse in 2005, which went to the most outstanding owner. You know, 4 years in a row, he had had more earnings than anybody in North America, and he also ran into trouble with regulators pretty much everywhere he went, and he ended up in Pennsylvania in a farm and a training center there because he couldn't get stalls at a lot of tracks. Pennsylvania was right in the middle of the mid-Atlantic. He had access to 3 or 4 casino tracks. Casino tracks had purses 4 or 5 times, often the worth of a horse. He was in the garden spot. And during 2009, 2010, he had a stretch where 9 horses broke down in 10 races. It all came to a head in January of 2010 after the third, I believe, within a week, did again break down. Jockeys were sent to the hospital. The jockeys had complained to the commission. There was a state police investigation underway. The track knew about it. Everybody knew about it, but nobody did anything. And that's what the jockeys ended up having to step forward one night and said, enough is enough, and we're not going to ride any race that a Gill horse is in. And that brought the heat down.
And when you say they knew about it, what they knew was that his horses were breaking down disproportionately. They didn't have evidence of doping, right?
They had investigative reports from a state police investigation that said that had interviewed employees at his ranch. They had had a positive test on one of the earlier horses. They had caught one of his horses coming into the gate in October, the gates of the track in October, with the ingredients for an illegal concoction. There was enough red flags up there. The track veterinarian, he had talked to police and said, yes, we had suspicions about him. A lot was known.
We don't have Mr. Gill here to give us his side of this. What happened in this case? Was there a sanction?
What happened was he basically left the business, sold all his horses. He claims, and he came out again last week, and we had talked to him several times, that it was not him, it was the track, that he was never at that training center very much. He didn't certainly instruct his employees to cheat, and he had nothing to do with it. He is now suing the jockeys as well as the state commission for having his due process violated.
He basically said that also that there were a lot of jealousies from his winning, and he was an outsider, and the locals didn't like him and therefore ganged up on him. That's his position.
We'll hear more of the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with Joe Drape and Walt Bogdanich in the second half of the show. Their investigative series about the horse racing industry was published in the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback, angieslist.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care, on the web at rwjf.org. And from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new comedy, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, from the director of Shakespeare in Love, now playing in select theaters. This is NPR.
Coming up, how the introduction of slot machines at racetracks has affected the economics of horse racing, as well as the safety of horses and jockeys. More with Walt Bogdanich and Joe Drape, who have been investigating horse racing in the U.S. for the New York Times. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new movie Dark Shadows. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview about how practices in the horse racing industry are putting horses and jockeys at risk. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke with Walt Bogdanich and Joe Drape about their New York Times series investigating the horse racing industry. They report that 24 horses die every week at racetracks. Many horses are running with injuries masked by pain relievers or are racing on performance-enhancing drugs. Regulation is lax, and the addition of casinos to many tracks has skewed the economics of the sport.
What kind of drug screening, if any, is done among horses at tracks?
Well, after the race, the winner is tested, and generally one other horse. But I found that, incredibly enough, that the budgets are so tight at some states that they take samples from these horses and they end up not testing them. In other words, if the trainers, if the owners see us taking these samples, they're not going to want to get caught. So the sample that we looked at was really a small sample, small percentage of the horses that are actually tested. And they screen for, gosh, any number of pain medications and other drugs. There's quite a long list of them. Some laboratories are better at it than others.
And Dave, there are tests for EPO, for example, and blood doping is one that has been suspected and there's plenty of evidence of. But that test is like $600 or $700, and most states won't take it because they cannot afford it. We've had regulators and vets tell us every time we find a test and it starts working, they figure out a way to adjust or they move on to another drug. So it's really sort of a whack-a-mole game out there.
And there are some substances that simply can't be detected by test in horses, right?
Correct. I mean, something, for instance, like cobra venom. You'd say, what on earth would a trainer be using cobra venom for? Well, what it does is it paralyzes that particular part of the leg, and the horse cannot feel pain. Now, unfortunately, according to the people we talk to who want a cleaner industry, cleaner, more honest races, they do not have a test for that just yet. And there are other drugs that they know and strongly suspect are being used, and they're told they're being used, but they have not yet been able to devise a test. And so that's of considerable concern to those in the veterinary community who care about horses and want to stop the abuse of those horses.
And there's also an aspect of experimental. I mean, tests have come up positive from everything from Viagra to feed for pigs that somebody suspects has a steroidal effect that'll boost it up, cancer drugs. There's a lot of these guys in the backstretch who, if somebody says this will make your horse run faster, they will give it a shot. And, you know, there's no test for them, and nobody really even knows if it works or not.
And there's a fear among trainers that if their competitors are using something that may or may not work, well, you know, I might be at a disadvantage. So they're going to use it too if they can get away with it. And I think that's driving a good part of the use of these improper drugs.
You've written that the presence of slots casinos at racetracks have changed the economics of this. Let's just go over the basics here. The horse racing industry liked the idea of opening up slots at racetracks because they would bring patrons and increase gambling. How has that affected the economics of races themselves?
Well, in the 90s, the great belief was slot machines and casinos were going to prop up a dying, struggling game. And the way it was going to work is casino companies would want to break new frontier on the East Coast in the Midwest and bring their games and their slot machines to the public. And to do that, the horse racing industry was going to put a tax on them. It's 12%, 17%. It varied from state to state. And basically, that went to purses and breeding programs. So, you know, this was new money. Better horses was the expectation. We're going to run for more money. What eventually happened, and it happened quickly, was you basically had welfare for horsemen. You had anybody with a few horses, inexpensive horses, could come. And let's say this horse was worth $4,000 on paper. All of a sudden, you could run for $20,000. You could run for $40,000. It was what Walt had said earlier. It encouraged bad behavior. The horse's life was not as worth as much as the plot.
Now, with this casino money coming into the horse tracks, did that mean that there were more races run?
Yes, because the state was benefiting as well. They were taking a cut of the revenues from the casino and giving it to education, to give it to hospitals, to give it to county governments. So everybody wanted more, and more races, more race days meant more revenues.
Yeah. What we had, as Joe pointed out, was a declining horse population, and yet there was a demand for races because there was a lot of money to be made. And so if you have a horse that might be tired a little bit, or one that you would normally turn out and have it graze for a while and get healthy on its own, with the lure of big casino money and big prizes, those horses are going to continue to race in cases where they otherwise would not. So what you had is a demand for races, but there wasn't enough product out there, high-quality product.
So the fact that the casino money comes into the track means that they are, what, running more races and offering bigger purses, and that's encouraging horse people to bring in animals that really aren't ready to run?
They're running for bigger purses, and they're running – the horsemen are tempted to just act badly, to not take – into consideration the health of their horse. You can either turn a horse out for 2 weeks and let him heal on his own, or you can give him a few shots and run him back in 7 days and maybe hit the board in third place and get enough money to pay for 3 months of training. So those were the sort of choices that were offered by the expanded casino purses.
Here's the problem. If you have these cheaper, less valuable horses and you own them, and you have this incredibly big pot that's all of a sudden been supersized, you might be more tempted to run that horse when you otherwise would not have done that. And as a result, we found at Aqueduct that the fatality rate had doubled after the casino opened. And that was a great concern to everyone in the industry. And now there's discussions about how to deal with that.
And in fact, Governor Cuomo put a limit on the pots. Now horses cannot run for twice their value.
And the logic there is that if I'm a horse owner and I have a horse that's worth $8,000, but there's a $40,000 pot or purse, it's worth taking a chance even if there's a risk that my horse will break down and I'll lose the horse.
Exactly. And now the rule is your $8,000 horse can only run for $16,000. So basically, you balance his health and welfare with what you can make at the racetrack.
Now, I've always thought that the top three finishers in a race won money, the win, place, and show. They're now giving money for anyone who finishes. Is that right?
They now pay a greater amount of money down through last place. In some jurisdictions, West Virginia being one of them, they will pay all the way down to the eighth. And we found a couple in West Virginia who basically win at a 5% clip out of 200 horses, but make a good living by running horses that get beat by 30, 40 lengths, 15 lengths that rarely compete. But they are paying down to last place. The one in particular was a horse named Star Plus that had formerly been owned by the ambassador of Finland, Earl Mack. And they got this horse, and they ran it. It got beat by 40 lengths, and they got $1,000 for it.
You have to understand, too, that when you have less expensive horses, that it costs money to keep them, to feed them, to care for them, to shelter them. And, you know, there are, unfortunately, and we are told, you know, some owners and who say, well, you know, why do I want to spend all this money on a cheap horse? Let's throw him out there. You know, he may win, he may not. And if he doesn't win, if he breaks down, well, then it's not my problem anymore.
What are the options for horses that can't really run competitively anymore? What happens to them?
Well, unfortunately, what we're finding is more horses are being mistreated, sent to slaughter, going past like trash. I mean, that's really the ultimate tragedy of it. The end of the line is nobody's taking care of them, and these are the athletes. This is the sport. This is who we come out to see. But, you know, the rescue groups and the retirement groups who do tremendous work, and they are out there hustling. They're bursting at the seams. They just can't do anything more. They can't keep up with all the horses coming out of the system.
So what's the moral obligation of an owner who has a horse that it's really not the right thing to race competitively anymore? What should they do with it?
The horse gives everything of itself, and the owner benefits from that. We would totally expect the owner then to pay back that horse by taking care of it I mean, these are incredible animals, and it's just unfathomable to me that there are owners out there who, after benefiting and profiting and banking money from the efforts of their, as they call it, equine athletes, that they would then turn their backs on these horses and, you know, get rid of them, turn them over to unsavory types who don't care for them, or in some cases actually, you know, to slaughter. And while it is illegal to slaughter horses in this country, it is not in Canada and Mexico.
We're speaking with Walt Bogdanich and Joe Drape, both reporters for the New York Times, who have done a series on problems in horse racing. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Walt Bogdanich and Joe Drape, both reporters for the New York Times, who've done a lot of reporting on problems recently in the horse racing industry. You write that some tracks are not accredited and don't seek accreditation. Is there any national regulation of tracks at all?
There's a National Thoroughbred Racing Association, which is sort of a trade group, and they have set up this health and integrity standard that they'd like all racetracks to meet. And basically it asks for best effort practices, including pre-race inspections, including testing. And what happens is you pay a fee, they come look at you. When they first announced this, they had pledges from 55 racetracks that they were going to do this. Here we are 4 years later, they only have 17 or 18 that have done that. And many of them, the casino tracks, said, no, we're not going to do it because it costs money. At Penn National, they weren't even doing pre-race inspections until this past October. To meet these standards is going to cost money and investment. So there is no really accreditation to speak of.
And then what about state regulators? Do some do a decent job?
Well, it varies from state to state. Let's take New Mexico, for instance, where I spend a good deal of time. I mean, there were some horses that were testing positive for pain medicine that was 10, 20, 30 times the allowable level. And they were allowed to continue to race without penalty. Now, the horsemen who are criticizing our numbers, I never heard them speaking out about that. Why don't they look at these numbers and say, well, how can we fix this? And as a result of our story, New Mexico is taking another look at how they regulate racing. They recognize that they have a problem. They've said that they had a problem. And they've also, in essence, thanked us for bringing this out in the open, which is now allowing them to try and make adjustments, to be tougher on the drug violators, to do a better job of overseeing this very important industry.
You write that in other countries there are national bodies which govern racing and impose tough regulations and sanctions when regulations are violated. Is there any appetite in Congress for taking this on?
They've introduced legislation and had a couple hearings. There seems to be some noise for it, but I sat through the hearings in Pennsylvania last week, and basically Ed Whitfield, a congressman from Kentucky, who wrote the legislation, said, look, I don't want this to end up in federal control either. There's a lot of things going on in this country, in this world, that need attention. I don't really think Congress wants to step into this and take this over and add another level of bureaucracy, but they do want something to change. And you know, again, I go back to that no law and order, no meaningful penalties. We've got a trainer of the Kentucky Derby winner, Doug O'Neill. He's had 15 medication drug violations. Three times he's been found to have milkshaked a horse. And a milkshake to a horse is a way of putting a tube down in their throat with some baking powder and a other concoction that's supposed to battle lactic acid and help them run through fatigue. In all his time, he's got a case pending right now. He may face 180 days of suspension, but in all this time, over these 10 years where he's occurred these infractions, he's maybe served 15 days of suspension, a suspension where he could turn it over to his assistants, his stable, and never miss a beat. The horses keep running. If they win, they keep getting their purses. You know, that's what America lacks that the rest of the world has. They have law and order.
So you're saying that the trainer of the winning horse in the Kentucky Derby has, what would we call it, a checkered history?
Doug O'Neill has 15 violations for drug overages, violations, what have you. He's been caught, or at least found guilty, of milkshaking horses three times, including in the Illinois Derby in a big race.
So we see these issues even in the Kentucky Derby. This isn't just little kind of marginal tracks near a racino.
Yes, we see these things at its highest level. 2008, Big Brown almost won the Triple Crown, got beat in Belmont Park. He was trained by Richard Dutrow. Richard Dutrow basically talked about the steroids he gave him. It brought the end of the steroid age, but it also shined a light on Richard Dutrow, who had more than 60 violations, 15 states all over the world, and New York basically banned him for 10 years for life. And they did it last fall, and he's still one of the leading trainers right now because nobody can enforce anything. It's in the court system. It's on appeal. He still has horses. He's still racing at the top levels. He may even have one in for the Preakness.
Do either of you take your families to the track? Is it a good experience?
I do take my family to the track. My son is 7, and he's been to Saratoga every summer. You know, a couple things. I've written books about horse racing. I actually love the sport. My dad taught me it when I was a kid. I went to Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Omaha, Nebraska, at my first racetracks. The history of it basically was America's first sport. It outdates baseball. It was essential to the American character. I've got a horse faster than yours. And the racetrack can be a great place, an exciting place. And I just got the ratings for the Kentucky Derby. 14 million people watched it, and over half of them were female. So it has sort of a cross-cultural allure. These are beautiful animals running their hearts out. The excitement of you're invested in it for $2 if you want to be for 2 minutes. The whole, I guess, environment and ecosystem of a racetrack. So, yes, I do see the attraction of it. And, you know, if anybody asked me, I would just say less is more. That it's one thing to walk through Saratoga, which works, Keeneland, which works, Delmar, which works, where you got 30,000 people there and everybody's having fun, versus Penn National, where there's 70 people at night in the cold betting on these 6 or 7 horse fields, mainly just because they can.
Well, Joe Drape, Walt Bogdanich, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke with New York Times reporters Walt Bogdanich and Joe Drape about their investigative series on the horse racing industry. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Dark Shadows. This is Fresh Air. The Gothic soap opera Dark Shadows ran on TV from 1966 to 1971 and amassed a sizable cult following. Now comes a feature directed by Tim Burton, starring Johnny Depp as the resurrected vampire Barnabas Collins. Film critic and longtime Dark Shadows fan David Edelstein has a review.
Two score and 4 years ago, I'd fly home from fourth grade for the 4 p.m. broadcast of Dark Shadows. In 1968, vampires and werewolves weren't mainstream. Horror films mostly played drive-ins. Yet here on TV was a daily horror soap opera. In 1966, creator Dan Curtis conceived of a show that was gothic but non-supernatural, like Jane Eyre. But after less than a year, with Dark Shadows on the verge of cancellation, he threw a Hail Mary pass, directing his writers to add a vampire. In came Barnabas Collins, played by Canadian actor Jonathan Frid, a villain meant to be staked through the heart after a few months. Then, fan response went through the roof, and Barnabas became a lovelorn hero, fighting against his curse, a predecessor to Twilight's Edward Cullen, while 40-ish bachelor Frid became an unlikely teen girl heartthrob alongside Bobby Sherman. While the plotline was nonsensical, the pacing torturous, and the budget tiny, Dark Shadows cast a spell. It's hard to suppress my preference for talking about the original over Tim Burton's film, which isn't a remake so much as a mostly unfunny camp send-up. The script by Seth Graham Smith is witless and meandering, and I wouldn't mind the witless so much if it moved, or the meandering if it were droll. There's no evident love of the genre, as in Burton's splendid Hammer Films homage, Sleepy Hollow, and a lot of the targets are low-hanging fruit, like loud 60s and 70s fashions, or a late 18th century vampire finding himself in 1972, pounding on a TV set and calling Karen Carpenter a tiny sorceress. Okay, that's funny. Still, I can't tell why Dark Shadows was made, apart from Johnny Depp wanting to play Barnabas. The 1790s prologue is played straight, although it hurtles by so quickly it feels like coming attractions. Barnabas, heir to the Collins estate, Collinwood, on the Maine coast, sleeps with and then jilts a servant girl, Angelique, played by Ava Green, who turns out to be a witch. The jealous Angelique compels Barnabas's true love, Josette, to fling herself from a high cliff, curses Barnabas with vampirism, and arranges for him to be sealed in his coffin for eternity. Dug up 2 centuries later by backhoes, the vampire discovers that the class-envious Angelique not only lives, but has taken over the fishing village of Collinsport and driven the aristocratic Collins family into near bankruptcy. In between ripping out throats and swooning over Collins' governess Victoria Winters, a dead ringer for Josette, played by Bella Heathcote, Barnabas vows to restore the family fishing business. And so, Dark Shadows becomes a business farce in which Depp's taloned, whey-faced bloodsucker constantly fends off the sultry green's advances.
With each life I take, a piece of my wretched soul dies. For I only kill because I'm compelled to. Compelled by your witchcraft, by your curse. Why have you done this to me?
It's a shame. You know, if you'd just been smart enough to love me, I would have let her go. I sent your little girlfriend over the cliffs once before. What makes you think I wouldn't do it again? I'm gonna offer you a business proposal, Barnabas. My final offer. Either you agree to rule this little pawn of mine side by side, partners and lovers, or I put you back in the box.
I have already prepared my counterproposal. It reads thusly. You may strategically place your wonderful lips upon my posterior and kiss it repeatedly.
kiss my posterior indeed. At least Ava Green is a loose-limbed, glittering-eyed, seductress cum terminator, and too much woman, if you ask me, for Depp's lightweight ghoul. It's great that he didn't go the dreamy movie star route to compete with Twilight, but his Barnabas is at the other extreme, a freaky little boy in a Halloween costume. The other actors look amusing in Colleen Atwood's eye-popping clothes against Rick Heinrichs' hyperbolic gothic sets, but they're playing one-joke characters. In the old Joan Bennett matriarch role, Michelle Pfeiffer does a starched great lady turn with spasms of mugging, while Helena Bonham Carter, in a flame-red wig, plays Dr. Julia Hoffman as a conniving dipsomaniac. Chloe Grace Moritz has bright moments as the teenage Carolyn, but everyone else, including Christopher Lee and a handful of original Dark Shadows actors, are trotted out to no good end. Tim Burton exults in things offbeat, droopy, morbid, but the ghoulishly amusing images notwithstanding, Dark Shadows is dead on the screen.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. From the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school. At wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the 25th anniversary of Fresh Air's debut as a daily NPR program. We'll listen back to highlights of Fresh Air concerts, including performances by Richard Thompson, John Doe, Shirley Horn, Nick Lowe, and Susanna McCorkle. And we'll have a little Name That Voice guessing game. Happy anniversary to us on the next Fresh Air.